Welcome back to Restless Viking Radio. I'm Chuck. Last time, we talked about the moment someone hands you responsibility and simply expects you to carry it. Not later, not when you're ready, right now. This week's story takes us farther north, out into Lake Michigan, to a place most people never see. A small, lonely island with an old lighthouse, in long stretches of time where the only real job is to stay. This is Poverty Island. The blue expanse moved like a conveyor belt of blinking waves. Calm, undramatic, but the wind, the goddamn wind, it howled that day. I hate running my small Zodiac Thor in big wind. It's low, cramped, and guaranteed to wake up muscles you forgot about. And slow, painfully slow. A 30-minute run on a good day can turn into 4 hours of rocking and bucking, teeth rattling, progress measured in stubbornness. You stop checking distance and start checking whether anything important has shaken loose. Still, something would not stay contained. I had to go. Not heroically, not dramatically. It just had to happen. It was a few years after I stopped running expeditions. Another 20 years of planning routes and teaching skills, managing risks, handling complaints, wiping noses, and encouraging followers to become leaders. I was done with that. Done with authority. Done with responsibility for other people. It was time to luxuriate in a different kind of adventure. Solo, quiet, and still a little risky. So I pointed the bow toward a place I had been before, Poverty Island. A rarely visited island in Lake Michigan, just a few miles offshore. Close enough to feel insignificant on a map right up until you decide to go there. The wind had a full 200 miles to stretch its legs, open fetch from Chicago all the way north. Where I stood, Lake Michigan gathered itself, stacked up in the shallows off the Garden Peninsula, and started chewing anything dumb enough to be out there. Between the islands, the water fought itself, confused, overlapping seas tumbling like squirrels in a pile, each wave trying to get somewhere different. I took the shallow route. I knew the charts. I read the water. I watched for reeds when things got too thin. Before I could change my mind and head back to a campsite for coffee, I launched between the rickety old commercial gill netters and trap net tugs lined up like a Popeye movie set. It was the docks of Fairport Fisheries. Tight quarters, questionable angles, but the only easy launch closest to the islands. The place smelled like wet rope, diesel, and fish that didn't fight much anymore. I powered up just off the dock and clocked the first mile in a couple of minutes. Buzzing across the water, fast and efficient, making good time. Then, all at once, the bow bucked. The Zodiac launched. The prop ventilated. The engine screamed its sudden freedom. For a split second, everything, gear included, hung in the air before collapsing back onto the deck. I winced, more for the equipment than myself. The lake didn't care. That was the end of speed. From there on out, it was a crawl, heaving over the waves as they slapped Thor from every direction. It felt like I stepped into an argument already underway and was trying to navigate the crossfire. As I crawled between little and big Summer Islands, I could see the scraggly little groups of weeds poking up. Summer Island blocked the waves, but it was too shallow now to risk speed. So we trolled between them, me standing at the wheel, squinting for a path, Thor holding his breath. I found myself talking to the boat, not encouragingly, just narrating what I hoped would happen next. It took an hour to crawl back to the tossing water. I was over an hour into the trip when I finally left the shallow water between the islands. I could see Poverty Island, a dark, squat line in the churning water. It didn't seem to be getting any closer. We flopped back into the big water, pounding onward, waves rushing past while the islands barely shifted. Progress became something you assumed was happening, not something you could verify. And then I felt off. Not bad, just unsettled. The horizon wasn't agreeing with me. For a second, I thought, am I getting seasick? And that made me laugh. I'd crossed oceans without a problem. I'd been tossed in Lake Superior storms. I've even spent years teaching people how to manage discomfort. And here I was, in a 16-foot Zodiac on Lake Michigan, mildly seasick. The feeling passed, but the lake apparently had a sense of humor. The wind turned the waves into spray and water collected in the back. I pulled the one-way scuppers and let it drain. The water that ran out was cold enough to remind me where I was. Waves came from different directions, refracting around the islands, some from port, some from starboard, and every so often, two collided in front of the bow, rearing up briefly before collapsing back into the mess. The boat never quite found a rhythm. Lake Michigan has a way of reminding you that inland is a scientific term, not a behavioral one. The crossing wasn't dangerous if you knew what you were doing. It was dangerous if you didn't, and I thought I knew what I was doing, mostly. Poverty Island looks close on a map, a few miles offshore, nothing really. Until something goes wrong. If you get hurt out here, you're hours from an ambulance. If the boat won't start, you set up camp and wait. Maybe overnight, maybe longer. There's no ranger station, no quick response, and no one just swinging by. The wind would have plenty of time to keep talking. This isn't theoretical remote. The island has proven it. Fire on Poverty Island has been worse than most people imagine. 4 years earlier, lightning struck in June. Fire crews managed to protect the lighthouse, but the ground kept burning quietly beneath the forest floor into January. It wasn't water or manpower that finished it. It was snow, a thick, patient blanket that finally smothered what no one could reach. The old lighthouse sat on the windward side, exposed to today's tumbling mess. We churned past the shoreline, progressing by the yard. Then I saw it, a small, brushy opening. I pointed the bow directly at it and kicked the throttle up. Thor yawned wide, but the waves came from behind and picked us up like a surfboard, stealing steerage and swinging the bow back and forth as we threaded toward the cut in the trees. I kept my eyes locked on the opening and tried not to think about what missing it would mean. The bow swung left, I corrected, it swung right. The gap was narrower than it looked from out here, and the winds weren't interested in precision. For a second, I thought about aborting, circling back, and waiting for a lull. But the idea of spending another 20 minutes getting tossed around out here made the decision for me. The restless lake pushed us into the calm pocket of a tiny lagoon. The old lighthouse rails still climbed out of the water, waiting for a crew that hadn't come in more than a century. The brush tried its best to hide it. I touched Thor's soft bottom to the rusty steel and hopped out with a handful of rope. I windmilled my arms through the brush to find a tree that would hold. My hands came away sticky and smelling like sap. I gathered my day pack, checked for a compass, and unfolded the waterproof case. A faint century-old dotted line stretched from the shore across the island to two small, square symbols. The trail, I figured. About a half a mile. I pulled out the GPS, took a coordinate off the map, and entered it. The display said 0.52 miles to the lighthouse. That sounded about right. The old landing was well lived in. A small improvised table was nailed between two trees, a few tarps stained and faded. Rocks ringed a pile of charred wood and wet trash. It looked like a place used by campers or by people who didn't bother to hide it. The clearing narrowed as I walked toward the place where the trail should be. Soon it narrowed to a sun-dappled path, moss covered with centuries of footsteps underneath it. 25 steps in, it ended. A pile of tangled trees lay across the trail, stacked above my head and interlocked like they'd fallen together. I ducked under one trunk and was immediately netted by brush and vines. I pushed through, bark scraping skin, sharp wood leaving those familiar stinging reminders. The smell was old wood and damp earth. I heaved forward and landed back in the path. 10 yards ahead, and another heap waited. Jesus, I whispered. I went in again. 15 minutes had passed. I hadn't gone far. The trail kept doing the same thing. Short stretches of open ground, followed by another collapse. I tried angling off to one side, then the other, looking for where it might have gone around the mess instead of through it. Every option ended the same way. More deadfall, more tangled brush, the ground broken and uneven. My shins learned this before the rest of me did. Then it was a solid tangle. No gaps, no breaks, no more trail to follow. I stood in the middle of it all. I checked my GPS, 0.31 miles to go. I stood there longer than I meant to, blinking at the display, trying to remember what I was supposed to think. It was quiet in that way burned places get, the sound dampened by fallen timber and new growth trying to decide what came next. I noticed my breathing, the warm sweat soaking my shirt, information that I would have used differently once. To the side, it was clear above the tangle. The trees had gone down together, laid flat in different directions, their trunks bleached and stripped. Far across it, maybe 150 yards away, a skinny tripod stood alone, 20 feet high, thin against the sky. A painted plastic barrel sat perched on top of it. It looked absurd out there, human, distinct, unreachable. It took longer than I expected for my breathing to settle, and that surprised me. For a moment, my mind did what it's been trained to do, not panic, inventory. If something happened here, if I went down hard and didn't get back up, it would be a while before anyone noticed. Someone might stumble across the boat first, or maybe not until the weather changed and somebody wondered why it was still sitting there. The thought passed as quickly as it came. I straightened up, checked the GPS again, and stepped back toward the trail. At least I hoped I was still on the trail. 0.31 miles. Everything had changed since I was last here. The fire had been a hard one, nearly impossible to fight. No place to land equipment, no easy access. They tried, but the fire burned into the roots, smoldering underground. Eventually, winter finished what crews couldn't. But the forest didn't recover. It collapsed. Trees fell for a couple years after, across the trail, over each other, tangled with vines and undergrowth. The path still existed, technically, but now it ran straight through a massive deadfall. I thrashed onward, breath labored, ice stinging from sweat. After a while, my pack caught on something. God damn it, I yelled as I jerked free. It let go, and I stumbled forward into a sticky mess of burdock. Knots of natural Velcro-like balls piled in my hair, stuck to my collar, holding my pant leg. Fuck! I jerked again. My pack swung free. Then it stopped, solid, and stayed. I pulled. I strained. Nothing worked. I couldn't move. I rolled my eyes and groaned, long and ascending, until it crescendoed into a primal bellow. I unclipped the pack's belt, loosened the straps, and gingerly slid out of my pack as it hung firmly in the air. I stared at it, swinging lightly, suspended like it was sticking its tongue out. "Are you shitting me?" slipped out, quiet and automatic, like I'd just found my keys in the refrigerator. I jerked it from its perch. It didn't let loose. I rolled my eyes. I positioned myself like I was about to wrestle a bear, paused, then heaved with an angry grunt. I heard a tear, and then a zipper let loose on a compartment, and gear tumbled to the ground. The pack still hung there, frayed and sagging, unzipped and defeated, but still perched. It was time to settle down. I put my hands on my hips and said something like, "Serenity now," then tried to think of a happy thought. I imagined a golden glass of bourbon neat sitting on a bar. I sighed, gathered the gear, and stuffed it back in the pack. Then I hacked it free from the tangle and slid it on my back with a foot of thorny vine still hanging from it. "Whatever," I muttered and pushed on. I eventually broke free of the fallen forest back onto the old path, mossy and neat. "Finally," I hissed. Somewhere between the end of the trail and the lighthouse, the wind let go. I noticed it not because it stopped completely, but because it shifted. The push that had been working the lake all morning was gone. What replaced it was lighter, undecided. The water still moved, but it had lost most of its bite. At first, I heard the water, quiet, gentle static almost. Then the sound thickened, a faint but long drawn-out crash underneath it. As I crested the rise, the sky came into view. To the west, severe clear. To the east, low cloud. The line between them ran clean and deliberate across the day. Everything felt exposed, but no longer under pressure. I passed an old collapsed cabin behind the lighthouse, mostly out of sight. It stopped me. Years earlier, when I'd been here, the building had been lived in, used. There had been a kitchen table, bunks with mattresses, a map spread out across the table, a shelf with salt and other spices for cooking, an ancient wood stove made from a barrel sat in the corner. Now it was just a heap. If you picked through it, you could still see what my memory saw, but only if you already knew where to look. I had to measure it differently today. See it for what it was, not what it had been. Not what it suggested, just wood, rust, and collapse. Nothing, really. The area felt more open now. Before, the cabin had been tucked into the woods like a cottage from a fairy tale. Today, it just said, "I used to be someone," like an old man on a park bench near the end. I followed one of the narrow lighthouse sidewalks, 16 or 18 inches wide, still there, still laid straight toward the tower. The woods had pulled back, leaving it more exposed than I remember. I looked into the old keeper's building. The roof had mostly collapsed. Before, it still had been a framework. Now, the walls told the whole story. The roof had given up. The place was no longer failing. It had failed. And that's when I took the camera out. I started documenting what felt like the slow death of a lighthouse. I thought about an article that I'd read that called it the most endangered lighthouse in the United States. It wasn't endangered. It was dead. Rotting in place, the way roadkill disappears into the shoulder over time. The walls were still stout, the tower still stood, peeling but strong. I circled the lighthouse on the narrow sidewalk and came to the door of the breezeway that once connected the keeper's house to the tower. A steel door lay unhinged, leaning uselessly nearby. Through the doorway was the familiar window on the far side. It looked like a painting on a wall, a coastal scene framed perfectly. The slope down to the water, waves crashing in, gray sky pressed low. I spent more time than I needed trying to capture it on camera. Not the scene exactly, the feeling of it. Trying to measure it the way you do with a painting, standing too close, stepping back, never quite satisfied. I climbed the few steps to the breezeway. I paused at the window to take in the view. Waves followed one another in, breaking into bubbling confusion as they met the rock floor below. Then I turned toward the entrance to the tower. It used to be blocked by cinder blocks, carefully mortared sometime after the light was deactivated. It was professional. But that doesn't last long in Upper Michigan. People up here have a habit of tearing down walls and obstacles. A few of the blocks lay broken on the floor. The spiral staircase was rusted, but in surprisingly good shape, solid. It was proud. I climbed it carefully. The steps were thick with rust, the air anciently musty. At the top, an improvised wooden hatch had been installed years ago. Thick plywood, painted gray. I wasn't sure why anyone had bothered painting it. It didn't matter. The lock still clung to the hasp, solid as ever, but the hasp itself had been ripped from the lighthouse years ago. The hinges were gone, too. The hatch had simply been placed back in its square opening carefully by whoever had last been here. I pushed it up. Bright sunlight poured in and a seagull jumped from the board. Its small body hopped once, then turned, jumped again, and lifted off. A moment later, a couple of its friends followed. I pushed the wood aside and climbed on to the top. The lantern house had been removed decades ago. I stood on a flat concrete floor, what must have been the base to the lantern room. 70 feet up, no railing, nothing between me and the lake. The island fell away immediately. The keeper's house sat directly below me, collapsed inward on itself. The roof was gone. A few rafters still clung to one another, holding a shape that barely qualified as a structure. Everything else had fallen straight down, boards and beams piled where rooms used to be. From this height, it looked less like a building and more like a memory of one. I walked to the edge slowly, careful with my footing. The concrete was rough and uneven, chipped and weathered. Rust flakes clung to the metal rail remnants at the perimeter. It was a long way down. I took the camera out. I started filming the view straight down first. The broken geometry of the house, the chimney still standing. The way the forest wrapped around it, green, interrupted by pale, burnt trunks. Fire scars ran through the trees in irregular patches. The damage obvious from above in a way that hadn't been on the ground. I panned outward. The view opened fast, the island narrowed and then disappeared into the water. No houses, no docks, no boats, nothing moving except the lake itself. The horizon stretched clean and uninterrupted for miles. To the southwest, the lake looked calmer, long bands of color sliding past one another without urgency. To the east, it was different. Waves heaved into themselves, where they met the shallow rock shelf that extended out from the lighthouse. The water surged and pulled back, exposing the lake bed, then covering it again. The sound reached me a moment later, softened by height and distance. I turned slowly, filming as I went. The forest told its story from up here. Burned sections stood out clearly now. The trunks pale and skeletal among the green. Some areas were recovering. Others hadn't decided yet. The wind moved across the top without effort. Not pushing, not testing, just passing through. It tugged at my shirt and moved on. I lowered the camera for a moment and stood still. The height made itself known in small ways. A tightening in the calves, a subtle shift in balance, the sense that my body was making adjustments. I lifted the camera again. I filmed longer than I needed to. The house below, the shoreline, the water, the trees. Shots that would probably never be used. I wasn't thinking about edits or story, just capturing what was there while it was still cooperating. Eventually, I stopped recording. I stood there a little longer, long enough for the wind to pass a few more times. Then I turned back toward the hatch. A half hour later, I was back at Thor. I set the camera on a tripod and turned it on. I didn't fuss with the framing, just pointed it toward the boat and the water beyond. Enough to see what was happening, enough to leave it alone. I climbed into the boat and started loading gear back where it belonged, slowly, one piece at a time. There was no reason to rush now. When everything was stowed, I stepped back into the cockpit and turned the key. The engine spun immediately, fast, clean. The starter sounded strong and confident. Usually it took a second for the motor to catch and to settle into its familiar purr. This time it just kept turning over. No cough, no stumble, no change in tone, just steady electric whine, waiting for something else to happen. I let out a long breath. Not frustration, not worry, just the sound of time being spent. I held the key for a moment longer than I needed to, listening. Then I let it go. I stood there in the silence with my hand on the console, staring at the ignition. I pulled the engine cover off. The fuel lines looked fine, seated there where they should be. The filter was brand new, clear. Plenty of fuel in the tank. Everything looked exactly the way it was supposed to look. I turned back toward the console. I didn't think about it. I didn't need to. I just stood there, staring at the deck. The red of my life vest caught my eye, bright against the gray. Then I saw the coil. The kill switch lanyard hung loose, slack and obvious now that I was actually looking at it. I hadn't put the vest back on yet. When I unloaded gear earlier, the lanyard was still connected to my vest. It was for safety, so if I fell out, the kill key would come out and kill the engine. I didn't disconnect it from my life vest. When I turned from the console, it pulled the kill switch out of its seat. I hadn't noticed. I wasn't looking for a problem. I reinserted it, turned the key, the motor fired immediately. I let it idle for a bit and listened to it. I let the sound take up the space that my sigh had left behind. Then I stepped out, pushed the bow free, and climbed back in. I idled out of the lagoon and pointed the boat toward the open water. I took my time crossing back, not because I was struggling. The wind had settled. The waves had mostly given up their argument. I just took the long route. I could have aimed straight for the fishery, cut through the shallows the way I came, but I didn't. I swung wide instead, following the deeper channel around Little Summer Island, the route commercial fishing boats use, miles longer than it needed to be. In all my years out there, I'd never gone this way. Too far, too slow, no reason to. I throttled down, not idling, just trolling, slow enough to see things I'd missed. Cabins appeared between the trees, small, tucked in. I'd never noticed them before. Never had a reason to look. Farther out, another boat sat anchored near a cluster of rocks. An older guy in a ball cap, rod in hand, thermos wedge between his feet, waiting. I don't fish, never had the desire. There's no adventure in it. But watching him sit there, patient, I appreciated it for once. The stillness, the waiting for something that might not come. I kept my distance, wide enough not to disturb the water. He glanced up once, went back to watching his line. The channel widened, the water turned darker and deeper. The old tugs at Fairport came into view, still resting where they'd been when I left. Nothing had changed. Nothing had moved. A man stood outside the pole barn near the dock, sipping coffee, watching me pull in. He didn't wave, just watched. Then he turned and walked back inside the warehouse. I throttled down, nosed the boat toward the ramp, and cut the engine. The winch clattered as I clanked Thor up onto the trailer. Water poured off the tubes, pooling on the gravel. I tied everything down, slow, methodical, one strap at a time, then I started inventorying. Daypack, compass, map case, life vest. That's when I noticed the GoPro was gone. I stood there with my hand on the wet tube, staring at the empty space where the camera case should have been. I pictured it, still on the tripod, still pointing at the lagoon, still recording, documenting its own life. The light fading, the battery draining, me walking away without looking back. I imagined it there now, filming nothing, watching nothing, measuring nothing. It would sit there documenting until the battery died. Then it would just sit. The housing filling with water over time, maybe falling over after a few months, becoming part of the island, dying like everything else. I thought about going back. Hours more on the water, racing this time, the lake calm now, maybe an hour with a wide sweep to the island at full speed. I thought about the footage, the view from the top, the waves crashing in, the seagulls, the keeper's house collapsed below. The best video yet. I didn't fail. I didn't prove anything. I didn't conquer a thing. I just showed up. I stood there for a moment longer than I needed to, water still dripping off the trailer, pooling around my boots, the engine ticked as it cooled, the dock creaked behind me. Somewhere out in the lake, something splashed once and stopped. I turned toward the Jeep. By the time I pulled onto the road, the islands were already gone behind the trees. I drove home without replaying the crossing, without measuring the trail, without planning a return. That night, I slept. The next morning, I posted a short update. People had been following the satellite tracker on our Facebook page. They wanted to know how it went. Most of the messages were the same. When I was going back, whether I'd retrieve the camera. They went so far as to give advice on how I could still make video without it, and maybe write about it. They wanted it finished. And I understood that instinct. I lived inside it for a long time. But one message was different. It came from someone I'd served with in the Army years earlier. Someone who had been with me in places where showing up didn't guarantee anything except that you were there. He didn't ask about the camera. He said, "Sucks about the camera, but an excellent mission. Go home and sleep well." And that stopped me. Not because it was wise, but because it was familiar. We had both spent years in a world that demanded completion, clear objectives, clean endings, proof that effort counted. Somewhere along the way, without announcing it, something had loosened. I hadn't gone to Poverty Island to retrieve anything. I hadn't gone to prove endurance. I hadn't even gone to finish a story. I went because something wouldn't stay contained. Only later did I notice what hadn't followed me home. The urge to justify it, the need to explain it, the itch to turn back. The island kept the camera. I kept the rest. There's a certain kind of story we're taught to want. One where effort pays off cleanly, where the thing you go after comes home with you. where time, energy, and risk line up neatly and justify themselves? This wasn't one of those stories. Nothing was recovered, nothing was proven, nothing was tied up. The island didn't care that I showed up. The lake didn't reward me for the crossing. The camera stayed behind. And somehow, that didn't feel like a loss. Because there are moments in life that aren't meant to be completed. They aren't auditions, they aren't investments. They're just places where you stand for a while. Long enough to notice how you're measuring things now. Not by what you bring back, not by how hard it was, not by whether anyone else would understand, but by whether you were present, whether you stayed, whether you left without needing to justify it. Most of us have a poverty island somewhere in our lives, a choice that doesn't resolve, an effort that doesn't cash out, a day that doesn't translate well into updates or explanations. And still, it matters. Not because it changed the world, but because you showed up without trying to turn it into something else. Because sometimes, that's the whole measure. There's something about places like that, an island, a lighthouse, a stretch of shoreline where the wind has way more to say than you do. You arrive thinking you're there to do something, fix something, build something, solve something. But sometimes the real work is simpler than that. Sometimes the work is just staying long enough to see what happens. Next time on Restless Viking Radio, we finish this season with a story about two kids in the woods behind a small cabin who accidentally built something of their own. It's called The Kids Who Built a Colony. I'll see you there.